Thank you. We're going to go ahead and call the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is April 14th, 2026. We don't have a quorum yet, right? Do we? One, two, three. We do? All right, we do have a quorum. So with that, I will ask Chair Novotny, would you like to approve the minutes, move the minutes from April 9th?
I have read the minutes and I do approve.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
And do move them.
He does move them. All right. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of passage, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. All right. The first order of, oh, wait, I've got to read the thingy. Do I have the thingy in here? Oh, I used to see it. All right. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For your safety, security, and comfort, all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause and other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak to the sergeant staff wearing the gold ties. State troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given 2 minutes, which will be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for reentry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. All right, the first order of business, we're going to have a presentation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the guardianship of adults. And so I would invite them to the table, Ms. Randall, and it looks like Deputy Auditor Jody Rodriguez. And then do we need Jamie? Bring up to the table anyone that you need to, Ms. Randall. Okay, all right. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Scott. For the record, my name is Jody Munson-Rodriguez, and I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. I'd like to thank you all for having us here today to talk about our evaluation of guardianship of adults, which we released last April. Hopefully, some of you have gotten kind of our thick booklet, the entire evaluation report that we put out. Yeah, it is pretty big. We did have a lot to say. While we have numerous findings and recommendations in that report, today I'm going to be focusing on three of the key findings within the report. First, we found that there is inadequate oversight of adult guardianship in Minnesota. Although there are a number of factors contributing to this, it's led to a situation in which the state does not adequately ensure that guardians are appointed only when appropriate or monitor the safety and well-being of adults who become subject to guardianship. Second, we found that training requirements for individuals holding key roles in the guardianship system are inadequate. And finally, we found that the state lacks a process for individuals to register complaints about guardian performance in the judicial branch. Now, before I move on to discuss those findings more in detail, I'd like to provide a brief overview of guardianship, as it can be unfamiliar to many people. There may come a time in an adult's life when the adult is not capable of making certain decisions for themselves. One of the supports available to an adult in this situation is adult guardianship, a process through which the court appoints another adult, a guardian, to make decisions for an adult who is unable to make decisions on their own. Adults who are subject to guardianship have a wide variety of backgrounds, needs, and abilities, as you can see in the two examples on this slide of two people who were appointed a guardian. Some adults subject to guardianship may live independently, while others may live in group homes or with their families. Some may have a job, while others may be in a hospital or a care facility. The judicial branch estimated that at the beginning of fiscal year 2025, there were over 30,000 people subject to guardianship in Minnesota and over 41,000 guardians. Establishing guardianship for an adult is a formal legal process in which an individual must petition the court to ask it to appoint a guardian for the adult. Before the court can appoint a guardian, state law requires that the court determine two things. First, the court must determine that the adult is incapacitated, that they lack sufficient understanding or ability to make personal decisions and meet their personal needs. Second, the court must determine that the adult's needs can't be met with less restrictive alternatives to guardianship. Less restrictive alternatives refer to supports that allow the adult to retain personal autonomy and continue to make decisions for themselves. They include things like a healthcare directive or assistance with cooking or cleaning. A guardian may be somebody that the adult subject to guardianship knows, such as a family member or a friend, or the court may appoint a professional guardian, who is typically someone the adult didn't know previously and who is paid for providing guardianship services. State law outlines a number of different powers and duties that the court can grant to a guardian, a few examples of which are on this slide. If you have the full report in front of you, we outline those powers in full on page 10. Guardians' powers and duties tend to focus on helping the adult make personal decisions, such as where they'll live or what type of education they'll pursue. If an adult needs help making financial decisions, the court typically appoints a conservator. Although guardians and conservators share similar types of duties, we focus only on guardianship for this evaluation. Several parts of the judicial branch play key roles in guardianship. For example, judicial officers preside over guardianship hearings, decide whether to appoint a guardian, determine which powers and duties to grant to a guardian, have the power to address underperforming guardians, and more. Court staff collect and manage files, schedule hearings, and may contact guardians. And the State Court Administrator's Office, or SCAO, provides central administrative services to the entire branch, and a limited number of SCAO staff work directly for guardianship-related activities. For example, overseeing a federal grant, funding certain guardianship activities and providing training. The judicial branch's activities pertaining to adult guardianship are largely decentralized, so no single entity within the judicial branch is responsible for adult guardianship. Rather, most of the branch's activities pertaining to guardianship are managed within Minnesota's 10 judicial districts. For instance, one individual judicial district may determine how to staff and fund guardianship-related activities for the district, and they are each individually responsible for monitoring guardianship cases and enforcing requirements. After that overview, I'd like to transition to discussing some of our key findings and recommendations, and I'll start with issues related to guardianship oversight. First, we found that there are few duties in law to oversee adult guardianship. All statutes require is that the courts establish a guardian registry and establish a system for monitoring guardianships, including reviewing annual guardian reports. Statutes do not indicate how the courts should monitor guardianships, such as whether the court should monitor whether guardians are performing the duties granted to them or whether the needs of persons subject to guardianship are met. The branch's primary approach to monitoring guardianship cases is to have court staff review the reports that statutes require guardians to submit. These reports, personal well-being reports, are required by law to include information on the condition of the person subject to guardianship, and guardians are required to submit them annually. In practice, as we discuss in detail in the report, we found that the usefulness of these annual reports for monitoring guardianships is limited for a number of reasons, including that guardians in the cases we reviewed often included little information in their reports. You can see an example of the limited information a guardian provided in the report excerpt on this slide. As part of our evaluation, we attended a number of guardianship hearings and spoke with people subject to guardianship, guardians, SCAO, and court staff, judicial officers, and others working in the guardianship system, including attorneys. Through these conversations, we found that the branch has adopted a largely reactive approach to overseeing guardianship. The branch relies heavily on persons subject to guardianship or other interested adults to inform it of issues with guardians. For instance, the branch may become aware of an issue with a guardian after someone files a complaint or someone petitions the court to reverse a guardian's decision. Now, given the reactionary approach to overseeing guardianship, it might lead one to wonder how guardians are actually performing and whether this approach to oversight is sufficient. We found that neither the legislature nor the branch have established minimum performance standards for guardians. So, for instance, there's no requirement for how often guardians must meet with persons subject to guardianship. And in fact, there's no requirement that the guardian ever meet the person subject to guardianship in person at all. The key requirement for guardians in law is that they submit their annual personal well-being reports and certain notifications to the court. Guardians' annual reports are the primary source, often the only source, of information the branch has on the guardian or the person subject to guardianship. In reviewing a sample of guardianship cases, we found that guardians often did not fulfill their reporting and notification requirements in a timely manner. Of the 62 guardianship cases we reviewed, we found that guardians submitted all of their reports on time for only 8 cases. Across the 260 total personal well-being reports we reviewed, only 30% were submitted on time. Although we found pervasive issues with guardians failing to meet reporting and notification requirements in the cases we reviewed, there were limited to no consequences for the guardians who did not comply with the law. Statutes, for instance, allow the court to remove a guardian from a case if they fail to comply with reporting requirements. Yet only one guardian in the 62 cases we reviewed was removed as a result of performance issues, despite many guardians failing to meet reporting requirements in a timely manner year after year. We also found that district court actions to address noncompliant guardians varied substantially across the cases that we reviewed, both in terms of how quickly the court contacted guardians to obtain late personal well-being reports and what types of actions they took. For several cases we reviewed, the court's actions to obtain missing guardian reports did not adhere to branch requirements or state law. For instance, statutes require the court to issue an order to show cause if a guardian's report is not filed within 60 days of its due date. Yet the court issued an order to show cause for less than 20% of the reports guardians submitted over 60 days late. Several individuals in the guardianship system commented on the lack of accountability for guardians who do not fulfill their duties, as you can see in the quote on this slide. Branch and court staff said that although removing a guardian is an option, there may not be another person available to step in as guardian, leaving the court with few meaningful ways to hold a guardian accountable when they don't perform their duties. I've included an example on this slide to illustrate the current lack of accountability for guardians. As you can see, about 6 weeks after the report was due, the court sent the guardian a notice telling the guardian to submit their report or meet with court staff for assistance in doing so. However, the guardian neither met with court staff to address the missing report nor submitted the report. After that, the court issued 2 orders and held 3 different hearings in an attempt to get the guardian to submit the missing report. The guardian showed up at only one of the 3 hearings and still did not submit the report as required. About 6 months after the report was due, the court issued a warrant for the guardian's arrest. However, as of February 2025, the guardian still had not submitted the personal well-being report. The guardian had not been arrested. The court had not taken further action, and that individual remained the sole guardian of the person subject to guardianship. Throughout our evaluation, we found that despite its deep impact on the adults who are subject to guardianship, the state does not have an adequate approach to monitoring and overseeing adult guardianship. I mentioned earlier in my presentation that the branch's activities pertaining to guardianship are primarily decentralized across the 10 judicial districts. This approach isn't inherently problematic as long as the individuals who administer and oversee guardianships perform their work consistently and in accordance with requirements. However, as we discussed throughout our report, the court's approach to administering and overseeing guardianship has been inconsistent and not always in accordance with state law or branch processes. And these issues have persisted despite several branch efforts to ensure that the court take a more consistent approach to guardianship. Given the magnitude of issues we identify throughout our research, we believe that it's time for the legislature to take substantial steps to bolster the administration and oversight of adult guardianship. First, we recommend that the legislature establish a centralized entity in statute to administer and oversee guardianships. Moving guardianship responsibilities under a single entity will help the state to consolidate the number of staff working on adult guardianship cases, unify the responsibility for ensuring the proper performance of staff, and hopefully improve accountability and consistency within the adult guardianship system. In the report, we discuss various options for how to centralize guardianship work and some pros and cons of different approaches. For example, the legislature could consider centralizing this work within SCAO or establishing a separate board within the judicial branch, something akin to the guardian ad litem board. Second, we recommend that the legislature establish specific guardianship oversight and enforcement duties for that entity. The reactive approach that the branch takes to guardianship cases is not atypical for how the branch operates across all case types. However, we think the approach of relying primarily on people outside of the court system, particularly people subject to guardianship, to report guardianship issues to the court is flawed. Persons subject to guardianship are often vulnerable individuals, and it's important that the state ensure their safety and well-being. We also recommend that the branch establish a process for systematically reviewing adult guardianships. Guardians currently have significant authority and latitude to act with little guidance or oversight. A system to review adult guardianships would help to ensure that the court receives accurate, objective, and sufficiently thorough information about the person subject to guardianship and the extent to which the guardian is fulfilling their duties. Before I move on, I'll note that we discuss a number of other issues with guardianship oversight and provide several other recommendations in our report. Now I'm going to pivot and talk briefly about guardianship training. Overall, we found that the training requirements for individuals holding key roles in the guardianship system are inadequate. With regard to guardians, there are very few requirements that someone must meet to be a guardian. Guardians are not required to participate in any training prior to or after becoming a guardian, including training on their roles or responsibilities, and there are no requirements that guardians have any certification or specified education or professional background. This is the case regardless of whether a guardian is a family member or friend or a professional guardian who's paid for their services. There are likewise no training requirements for judicial officers who preside over guardianship hearings. Few courts in Minnesota have judicial officers who specialize in guardianship cases. And we found that judicial officers who preside over guardianship hearings do not consistently complete training on adult guardianship. Some judicial officers told us that they do not always know how to complete key tasks related to guardianship. As part of our evaluation, we surveyed all judicial officers who had recently presided over at least one guardianship hearing. Of the judicial officers who responded to our survey, only 35% of these officers said it was mostly or very clear how they should respond when they receive a substantiated complaint about a guardian. Judicial officers responding to our survey also indicated that they do not consistently follow key guardian appointment requirements in statute when determining whether guardianship is necessary. I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation that before a judicial officer can appoint a guardian, statutes require judicial officers to determine whether the adult is incapacitated and whether less restrictive alternatives to guardianship can meet their needs. However, judicial officers responding to our survey said they do not always do so, as you can see in the chart on this slide. For instance, only 64% of judicial officers said that they always determine whether the adult's needs could be met with less restrictive measures before appointing a guardian. We recommend that the legislature amend law to require all guardians to complete training prior to their appointment as guardian. Additionally, we recommend that the branch require all judicial officers who preside over adult guardianship hearings to complete training on guardianship. And finally, I'll talk briefly about guardianship complaints. Statutes do not establish any formal process for individuals to submit complaints about guardians to the judicial branch. Statutes also do not require the branch to review or address complaints that it receives about guardians. In July 2022, SCAO proactively introduced a complaint process for individuals to submit complaints about guardians to the judicial branch. This complaint process was considered a pilot project during our evaluation, reliant on limited duration federal grants to operate. As part of our evaluation, we reviewed data on all 245 complaints SCAO had received involving guardians from the inception of the complaint process in July 2022 through June 2024, and we found that the number of complaints SCAO received increased, as you can see on this slide. From January to June of 2024, SCAO received an average of 3 to 4 complaints per week. As the volume of complaints increased, the amount of time each complaint remained open increased as well, leading to a backlog. Since completing our evaluation, SCAO has taken numerous steps, including hiring additional staff to address that backlog, but continues to depend largely on a federal grant that ends in 2027 to fund complaint activities. As part of our evaluation, we reviewed several national organizations' recommended practices for adult guardianship and found that providing a complaint process is a practice recommended by several of those organizations. Additionally, several individuals we spoke with had positive things to say about SCAO's complaint process pilot. Since the branch is the only entity with authority to remove poorly performing guardians, we agree that it's important that people subject to guardianship and others in the guardianship system should have an avenue to submit complaints about guardians to the branch. Therefore, we recommend that the legislature establish a guardianship complaint process in law. And with that, Madam Chair, I've concluded my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Ms. Randall, did you have anything to add? Okay. Let's take all of the testimony first, and then we'll go to member questions. Is there a Jamie Majerus? Please come to the testifiers table. And Kayla Doobie, did I mess that up?
Nope.
Okay. Kind of like the Doobie Brothers, but spelled differently and meanings differently. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tapes and go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you for having us. My name is Jamie Majerus, and I'm the audit manager for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. So thank you for having us, Co-Chair Scott, Co-Chair Liebling, and members of the committee. Like I said, my name is Jamie Majerus. I'm the audit manager for the branch, and I'm here today with Kayla Doobie. She is our senior, one of the senior attorneys in the legal counsel division. And on behalf of the State Court Administrator's Office and the judges and the staff at the Minnesota Judicial Branch, thank you for the opportunity to appear for you, before you today. On behalf of the Minnesota Judicial Branch, I want to thank the Office of the Legislative Auditor for its work on the audit that was conducted last year. The audit brought valuable public legislative attention to the important issue of guardianship in Minnesota. Protecting adults subject to guardianship and treating them with dignity remains a responsibility we take seriously and we appreciate the opportunity this audit gives us to further strengthen our system. The judicial branch continues to share the legislature's commitment to ensure that guardianship in Minnesota is accountable and transparent. We believe guardianship should always be a measure of last resort, used only when truly necessary, and always with strong judicial oversight. While we acknowledge there is room for continued improvement, we're also proud of the work that Minnesota has done in modernizing guardianship oversight and of our role as a national leader in guardianship reform and innovation. Over the past two decades, the Minnesota Judicial Branch has invested heavily in developing technology-driven solutions to modernize case management, increase accountability, and improve service to vulnerable adults. This includes the development of My Minnesota Conservator and My Minnesota Guardian, online platforms created by the Minnesota Judicial Branch to streamline reporting by conservators and guardians. These tools have significantly improved transparency and oversight by making it easier for guardians and conservators to submit required reports and for courts to monitor compliance, flag concerns, and detect signs of potential abuse and neglect. These platforms have become national models for other states. The platforms also integrate with our statewide case management system to support effective and timely judicial review. Our leadership in this area was recognized at the federal level in 2021 and 2024 when the Minnesota Judicial Branch was awarded two separate competitive Elder Justice Innovative Grants from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The previous and current grants support the advancement of Minnesota Vulnerable Adult Care Project. It's a multi-year innovative focused on strengthening oversight, improving court processes, enhancing protection for adults subject to guardianship and conservatorship. With the support of these grants, we implemented a wide range of reforms. We've enhanced fraud and abuse detection and auditing and monitoring mechanisms, allowing courts to more effectively monitor compliance and spot red flags in financial reporting. The branch has also identified flags to provide additional monitoring in our guardianship application, MMG. This work is anticipated to be complete late summer 2026. We've established a new complaint and investigative process, as OLA mentioned, allowing anyone with a concern that a court-appointed guardian or conservator is not acting in the best interest of the person subject to guardianship or conservatorship to file a complaint that is reviewed by independent investigators who report their findings directly to the presiding judicial officer. With this grant funding, we hired dedicated staff, developed clear criteria for triage and investigation, and created protocols to ensure that complaints of abuse, neglect, and unmet needs are taken seriously and responded to appropriately. Since the audit, we've eliminated the backlog of complaints, and we've reduced our investigation closure time from 187 days noted in the audit to 88 days. This process has improved the branch's ability to respond to concerns regarding guardians. However, its long-term sustainability will depend on ongoing statutory authority and funding. In June of 2023, we established centralized guardianship teams in every judicial district to ensure consistency and accountability in how guardian reports are tracked, monitored, and enforced. These dedicated teams are responsible for monitoring compliance with annual reporting requirements, issuing notices when reports are late or insufficient, and escalating concerns for judicial officer review when necessary. By centralizing this work, we have reduced variations across counties and strengthened the ability to ensure that guardians are meeting their legal obligations statewide. We also conducted a thorough review of missing or late filings in guardianship cases, and the branch has resolved issues in over 1,000 cases. We have put additional processes in place to ensure guardianship filings remain current. Before the conclusion of the audit, we worked with the Department of Human Services to address the backlog of pending background studies for guardians. We added notifications to the guardian and conservator applications to provide family and lay guardians with reminders of their upcoming background study filing requirements and due dates. Court processes were clarified to also direct court staff to send notices to ensure guardians file background studies in a timely manner. We have also used the federal grant funding to expand and offer training and educational resources to guardians, conservators, court visitors, attorneys, interested persons, and judicial officers, ensuring those that are working with guardianship have the tools and the knowledge to fulfill their responsibilities. We continue to develop training and additional resources for judicial officers in guardianship and conservatorship. Kayla and I have recently been added to the new judge orientation to train on guardianship and conservatorship. The branch conducted an extensive review of guardianship cases and data. We developed guidelines for data collection and reporting to ensure consistency. Dedicated staff have reviewed and investigated and addressed thousands of cases. We have also created two reports to assist case monitoring for court administration, which was returned over 2,000 cases to be corrected since last fall. We're also looking at adding two additional reports for guardian case monitoring. We are also building external data reporting for statistics on guardianship cases for public use to see real-time guardianship data. Training for court administration staff that work in guardianship cases is being developed to reduce and eliminate data entry errors. These efforts have not gone unnoticed. The National Center for State Courts published a 71-page report documenting Minnesota's approach as a blueprint for other states looking to reform the guardianship systems from the 2021 grant. And most recently, the U.S. Government Accountability Office conducted an in-person visit at the Minnesota Judicial Branch, meeting and interviewing staff, as well as conducting visits at court locations. The office selected five states to review and conduct research to report on how federal agencies could better support improvement of the oversight and administration of guardianship cases. Included in the audit report is the Judicial Branch's response to the OLA's findings and recommendations. In this 10-page letter, you will find the areas of the OLA's report we agree with, a response to the OLA's recommendations that lay out the potential funding or bureaucratic hurdles associated with implementation, and detailed responses to each of the recommendations directed at the courts. To be clear, we continue to agree with many of the OLA's recommendations and believe they offer a solid roadmap for future improvement. Most notably, we support legislative action to reduce unnecessary guardianship petitions, increase information sharing among investigative entities, to improve standards, qualifications, and training for those involved in guardianship. That being said, many of the issues identified in the report raise broader policy questions for all three branches of government about how ongoing guardianship oversight should be structured and what responsibilities should rest with the courts versus other entities. We need to make sure that an effort to reform and improve guardianship in Minnesota respects the boundaries of judicial ethics and the constitutional role of our courts. Courts must remain neutral decision makers. Judicial officers are not investigators, and court staff cannot provide legal advice or determine legal sufficiency. Courts act on the information presented in each case, and our authority to impose and enforce requirements is defined by statute and court rule. We also recognize that many of the improvements suggested in the report will require additional resources. The expansion of the complaint investigations, formalizing periodic case reviews, strengthening the court visitor programs, these all take time, staffing, and sustained resources. Where the legislature establishes new and expanding requirements, the judicial branch will implement and enforce those requirements consistent with our role. Our courts stand ready to be your partner in better protecting individuals subject to guardianship, and we are committed to playing an active role in advancing this work. At the same time, we understand that the legislature is facing many competing budget priorities during this time in economic uncertainty, and we respect your constitutional role in deciding if and how to fund these investments needed to implement the report's recommendations. In closing, the judicial branch is proud of the progress we've made and clear-eyed about the challenges that remain. We thank the OLA for helping elevate these important issues, and we look forward to continuing to work with the legislature to ensure that Minnesota remains a national leader in protecting vulnerable adults. Thank you for your time, and we are happy to take any questions.
Thank you for being here today. Ms. Doobie, did you have anything to add?
No.
Okay, you're just there for moral support and to answer questions. All right, very good. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this particular topic? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for the OLA, and then I had a thought I wanted to share as well, just regarding your presentation and report. So I was curious, my understanding is that a significant majority of guardians in Minnesota are like family members and not professional guardians. And I was curious, do you see a difference in the complaints that you screened, the ones that you talked about in your PowerPoint and also on page 63, I think, in your report, between professional guardians and volunteer guardians and family members?
Ms. Rodriguez, I'll give you a second to get to that.
And I was curious also if, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was curious if the example that you gave was if you know if they were a professional or if they were a volunteer.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Feist. While Ms. Rodriguez is looking for additional information, I will start by saying that the data the judicial branch has on guardians, who's subject to guardianship and who is serving as a guardian, is very limited. It's basically found in each case file. And so it was not possible for us to do kind of data analytics across the broad data set. So in terms of, and perhaps for the complaints, because it was a smaller set, we were able to gather some of that information, but it would be hard for us to draw broad conclusions regarding that composition. And I'll also note that it takes a lot for somebody to complain about a guardian. Folks who are subject to guardianship are vulnerable, right? And they are, you know, under the care, and depends, of course, on the details of each guardianship, but they are under the care of this individual who at sometimes has a lot of control over them. And so the ability to complain is itself, I would say, a pretty big burden. And so we can only use the data we have, of course, but it may not be fully reflective of the issue. Just wanted to note that.
Ms. Rodriguez, if you want to go ahead, and then we'll see if Representative Feist has a follow-up.
Chair Scott, Representative Feist, thank you. We did not systematically look at whether the complaints were submitted regarding a professional versus a family or friend guardian. Because we didn't have any data to compare it to kind of look at the broader population, we didn't think that that was a data point that was going to be useful in the context of the overall look at the situation.
Representative Feist.
Thank you. I actually do think it would be very interesting and relevant to know, and maybe that ship has sailed, but I'll just say in my personal experience working on legislation around guardianship, the professional guardians have really pushed back on accountability. We passed law creating civil liability that was inadvertently left out of the original statute based on a 2023 Court of Appeals finding. And it was just language basically for like egregious type of negligence that caused harm. And the amount of pushback that we received was really shocking to me and pretty alarming. So I am curious about kind of the difference that we see in complaints between professional and family members.
Either one of you want to respond to that? Go ahead, Ms. Rodriguez.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Scott, and thank you, Representative Feist. I was just conferring with some of my colleagues who dug into the files, and they noted that that was not a piece of information that was systematically captured in all of the complaints that we looked at. One thing I will note, though, is that we did hear those same concerns kind of across the spectrum when speaking with individuals involved in the guardianship system. So I wouldn't say that was even just the guardians themselves. It was attorneys. It was judicial officers. We did hear some concerns as well, mm-hmm. as we note in our report.
No. Representative Feist?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for those responses. And I just wanted to also mention, it's like adjacent to what we're talking about today, but I would love to see us move to more opportunities for supported decision making to create more supports for people who are aging to, you know, have that dignity and that ability to make a lot of the decisions that they can make for themselves. And shout out to The Pit, which I'm obsessed with, where they actually did, they mentioned supported decision making in the context of one of the plots, and I was like, supported decision making. Anyway, so I'd like to see a lot more that we could do as a legislature and a state to encourage an expansion of supported decision making and less people who have to be under full guardianship. Thanks.
Representative Feist, I'm sure the writers for The Pit are watching your legislation and making the story based on that. So thank you. Who else? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. And my questions are in a similar scope to Representative Feist. So when I'm looking at the examples that you provided, my first question was, what is the situation in each of these cases? Are these family members who are guardians? Are they paid? You know, all of that. So, but my why I care about that is knowing the reality of families who have adults with disabilities or vulnerabilities or high needs in their family, and their family member is a guardian, having to do this report is not nearly the only thing that they are responsible for. And I'm comfortable saying that this is probably the last thing on their mind and probably least in priority if it, you know, when it comes to filling things out that are going to guarantee that their loved one continues to receive services, like their funding doesn't get cut off and that kind of thing. The paperwork involved in that is already quite cumbersome. We try to limit it as much as possible here at the legislature, but of course we have to be good stewards of our funds. Sometimes we just can't trim down the paperwork anymore. But I will say that for families, a lot of families, what this looks like is an elderly person or elderly couple caring for their adult child with developmental disabilities, where one or both parents are they themselves dealing with significant health concerns. Their own health is declining. This person's living with them and they're continuing to care for them while they're ensuring that funding doesn't get cut off. And part of the picture of all of this, too, I appreciate that you looked at when notices were sent out, because, of course, if you don't get a notice as a family, how are you supposed to know, right? You're supposed to write a date down and somehow in the chaos of your life remember this date like it's somebody's birthday. You're not going to remember that. But I will say that state agencies have been known to date letters or have letters ready to go on the date that it's supposed to go out, and the person on the receiving end doesn't get it for 2 months. So that's another sort of layer here of, sure, when was it sent out, but when did the person receive that letter? I've been on the receiving end of these letters in the provider space and got a letter from the mailman, opened it up, and the date on it is 2 months old. And it's a report that's significantly late already. We just got it today, right? So that's another layer of this. I really want us to be careful and considerate of the details in these stories, because it's quite possible that many of these examples are coming from overburdened families, and not necessarily, you know, bad actors trying to get away with anything. So I just want to make sure that we're conscientious of the whole spectrum of needs that families in this case might have, to the point of folks who are paid to do this. There's no excuses in those cases, and I'm much less lenient in those cases.
Thank you, Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran, for those comments. I think it's helpful to take a step back in terms of what the state is doing generally to ensure that guardianship services are appropriate and in the best interest of the ultimate recipient. We focused on those reports in part because that's really one of the only mechanisms the state has put in place to provide any type of oversight. And so, you know, I think our interest in this report especially is not that anybody is a bad guy here. The judicial branch is not. The judicial branch has gone above and beyond what they've been required to do. I think guardians, for the most part, right, are going above and beyond. But I think what's startling, at least it was to me, about this report is really the lack of anything, I guess, to put it bluntly, around guardians and what controls or oversight or expectations the state has. I mean, these are people with a lot of authority for very vulnerable people. And we have a lot more regulation and oversight in cases where it's much less vulnerable people and people with much less authority. And so it's more kind of a call to everybody in this room. And I think your comments are great. I think Representative Feist's comments are great. And I think those are what's needed to come together and figure out where as a state do we want to be here? Where should that power reside? You know, it might not be with the judicial branch. It might be with another board. I don't know. But there's a lot of thinking that has to happen here. And I can't tell you how important we at OLA think this is. I mean, I really felt like this was one of the most important reports we had issued in a while in terms of the vulnerability of people and the gaps in state oversight. So I really went off script, but it's just, it's really, it really should capture the attention of everybody in this room, I think. And yes, more work has to be done, especially just in thinking, where do we want this responsibility to be? But it should be somewhere.
Thank you. Ms. Rodriguez, did you want to respond as well?
Thank you, Chair Scott. And just as an additional note, I'll say that it definitely isn't the majority, perhaps, that we need to be concerned about, because any individual that has a great support system, they're going to have family or friends that are looking out for them, ensuring that their needs are being met and that their rights are being respected. It's those that don't have that. And so I'm just thinking, we were able to talk to a number of people, both subject to guardianship people who were guardians themselves. And one of the people that we spoke with was a woman who was a guardian for her adult son. And she, you know, she very specifically said to us, I am not worried about my son. I am not worried about myself. But being in this system, I see plenty of people who don't have that support systems, and that's what I worry about, and that's why I hope that there are some changes. So just kind of sharing, absolutely, that's not I wouldn't say that that's the default, but sometimes we need to think about that smaller piece of what could happen.
Thank you. And just one request I have, too, is from the courts in your testimony. I'm wondering if you could forward that. You clearly have that written out. If you could forward that to the committee, I think that would be really helpful so we can juxtapose like what's happening on the ground in the courts with this report and moving forward how to solve this. I agree with you that one of the things that the legislature should do is protect the most vulnerable. And if there's an area where we're not doing that, then we need to fix it. And I had just one question, and then we'll Representative Rarick has, or Chair Rarick has a question. How in depth are these reports that the guardians have to fill out on an annual basis? About how long would it take to fill one of those out? How many pages are they? Is there somewhere here in the report that references that? Ms. Rodriguez or Ms. Randall?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. I would say that it really depends on the guardian. If you have the report in front of you and you'd like to turn to page 58 and 59, we have two kind of very differing examples. In some cases, you can just hit some radio dials and probably be done in 5 minutes. And you complete the report. You are completing your reporting requirements. You can submit them. But it really is giving very little information to the court to understand how the person subject to guardianship is really doing. On the other hand, you see on page 58, there are people that provide a good deal of information to really talk through things that have changed, needs that have changed, maybe needs that aren't or are being met. So it really depends on the guardian how long it will take.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The courts had testified, and in their testimony, they talked about fraud. And that word caught my attention. And I'm wondering if you could just expand on what your concerns are in regards to fraud. And we're talking about some of the most vulnerable people in the state of Minnesota. So when I heard that word, I was like, oh, okay, so what level? And since they're not supposed to be handling finances, but they're vulnerable people, so they could take advantage. If you could just expound on that, because that would be a grave concern for us.
Go ahead, Ms. Majerus.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. So my comments around fraud is in the conservatorship area. We have taken approaches in conservatorship and guardianship. So I oversee our conservator audit and review programs at the branch. We have a team of auditors and reviewers that are specialized in the area, and we conduct annual reviews, audits. A conservator is always in contact with the court being audited or reviewed. We joke, it's not like the IRS, it's not if you are audited, it's when. So we take a strong approach to that area, and we are watching for fraud in our conservatorship area. So you are correct, guardianship does not oversee funding, but I was just testifying to both areas.
Representative Rarick.
Yes, thank you, really quickly. So, but is there a concern since their guardians are not supposed to be dealing with the finances, but they're a vulnerable person? So is there any concern that they could kind of leak into that area and take advantage of somebody if they're not being closely monitored?
Ms. Majerus.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, there is a concern. So we do monitor for that and watch that. There are questions on the personal well-being report about collecting money, you know, charging monies when they for their fees for services that they provide. And then we also watch for represented payee efforts, which is also at a federal level, but we do watch for those. And then our complaint program also deals with any financial exploitation or concerns with guardianship as well.
While I've got you at the table, I'm just wondering, have the courts done anything, or do the courts feel it's their responsibility to have some sort of training for the guardians, as was noted in here, that is needed? Because I would think if someone appointed me as a guardian of someone with some pretty special needs, I wouldn't really know where to begin. And I know there are family members that are appointed guardian because there are no other living relatives and they don't really know that much about the person that, you know, they've been charged with overseeing or taking care of. So any response to the education piece?
Thank you, Chair. The courts do offer a lot of training. We've recently done complete redo of our guardianship and conservatorship training videos for proposed guardians and conservators. Those are available online. They have quizzes embedded with them, so to check for comprehension throughout. However, the statute does not require guardians to complete any training. So the courts have not imposed a requirement on guardians, but it is strongly encouraged in both our instructions. It's encouraged by the bench for all guardians and conservators to complete that training before appointment.
Thank you for that. I think that's a piece of maybe some low-hanging fruit that could right away, next session be something that we could just require of guardians. Thank you. Thank you all for being here for the informative discussion today. And I look forward to getting your written testimony. And this is obviously a subject that needs to be dug into deeper. So thank you. The next bill we have, Representative Johnson, House File 3901. Representative Johnson, thank you for being in the committee today. I will move House File 962. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong bill number. 3901. And I believe that you have an A26 amendment.
That is correct.
Would you like to briefly tell us about the A26?
So this amendment was a result of the ongoing conversations and a lot of conversations with the interested parties to address the concerns they had regarding the bill. So basically what this amendment does is that it recognizes their concerns and the desire to work together to make this work for all and for the foster parents that this bill was addressed to. And so that is my amendment. So.
Okay, thank you for that. Any discussion on the amendment? Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I think this is a pretty important issue. And because it's a line and page amendment, which is kind of hard to digest without going through and putting it into the bill, maybe nonpartisan could kind of tell us what it's doing before we adopt it.
Sure, great idea. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so bear with me. This is a reviser amendment. It didn't come out of our office, so this is the first time seeing it.
We'll be gentle.
Sure. On page 2, line 21, regarding the ombudsman's ability to enter and inspect residences and facilities where a foster youth is residing, it deletes without notice. In two places, it also specifically exempts tribal data and tribal placements at page 2, line 23, and at page 2, line 26. Finally, page 3, after line 5, and this is regarding the foster youth ombudsman person's authority or powers. It again specifically states that those authorities and powers do not apply to tribes in Minnesota, tribal social service agencies, and et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Chair Liebling, any further clarification needed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think we could adopt it and then have some more discussion about where the bill is at.
All right. Any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment has gone on to House File 3901. Representative Johnson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. And what I'll do is, in order to, I know, see how many bills you have on to kind of help you get back on schedule or shorten up my comments here, because I know it's being laid over. So thank you, chairs and members. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss House File 3901. A bill seeking to amend the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsman, Ombudsperson, also known as OOFY, and I'll call it OOFY going forward because it's more fun, statutory language. OOFY has now been open for nearly 2 years and has identified some areas of their statute that could use clarification and strengthening to ensure they are meeting their statutory charge of ensuring foster youth are receiving the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice. The bill addresses three primary gaps. First, the amendment explicitly affirms the office's right to direct login access to SSIS. Second, it includes the right for OOFY to meet privately with foster youth. And third, it aligns retaliation protections, and it goes more into detail like that. But together, these clarifications ensure the oversight functions as intended, protecting youth, strengthening accountability, and improving system performance. This bill does not expand OOFY's mission. It strengthens the mechanisms necessary to carry out the work's efficiency. We have Misty Koontz. Oh, sorry.
Misty is sick today, so.
Oh, okay. Well, they threw a curveball on me here. So I have a testifier here today, and I will let her testify or identify herself.
Perfect. Go ahead and state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Johnson, and thank you, members and chair. My name is Hannah Planalp, and I serve as a deputy ombudsperson with the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson, often referred to as OOFY. Misty Koontz, as I said, was planning to be here today, but unfortunately is unexpectedly out. In addition to our professional experiences, both Misty and I are fosters. We use capital F foster, following the lead of community advocates, to refer to those of us who experienced foster care, no matter how or when we left. I was in foster care in Colorado before there was an ombuds office, and I often think of what it would have meant to me 20 years ago to have a place to call for help. Our agency opened because of the advocacy efforts of fosters. We're grateful to the legislature for hearing those voices and taking meaningful action. Prior to the creation of our office, there was no clear independent pathway for foster youth to raise concerns or report potential violations of their rights. Since May of 2024, we have reviewed nearly 400 concerns from children, youth, and adults from at least 55 counties across Minnesota. We have several public reports we have shared outlining some of our investigatory work and the trends we are seeing. After nearly 2 years of operations, we are requesting changes in three areas of our enabling statute, as mentioned. I'm going to spend my time today discussing records access because I believe that's the area with the most questions coming up. The lack of direct access to Social Services Information System, or SSIS, is greatly impacting our ability to investigate decisions being made about children and youth in foster care. Since July, we have requested data from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families for about one case a week. So the vast majority of our requests go directly to counties, but there are situations where we might request directly from DCYF. And in that time, since this process has been put into place, the delays for us to get data have gotten longer and longer. Some requests, including those related to the decision-making of DCYF, remain unfilled. In one example, it took 2 months to find out whether a Minnesota foster youth whether there were Minnesota foster youth at a facility that had made national news due to some concerning allegations. DCYF has stated concerns about information that is protected through attorney-client privilege. However, the training to agencies is clear that privileged information between county workers and county attorneys should not be entered into SSIS. If that is happening, it should be addressed through the training of agency workers and not being used as a broad justification to block our access to information. The other data privacy concerns we've heard have been fairly nonspecific and vague. Federal guidance has been clear that data sharing with agencies in roles like ours is appropriate. Out of the 24 children and family serving ombuds in the country that responded to a survey, 18 have statutory login access to systems like we are requesting. So 18 of 24. We've not been able to agree on what UFI should have access to and what should be left up to DCYF to decide, or what a reasonable deadline for response may be. We've received conflicting information about who has access to SSIS and to what information. Ultimately, we are forced to believe that the barriers being presented to us are have no workaround, and when our requests go unfilled, there's little recourse for our agency. The changes proposed here clarify the role of our office and the data we need to fulfill our statutory charge. We've proposed several possible solutions, such as an interagency agreement, none of which have made any progress in the last 2 years. The reality is the delays are getting longer, and the objections are becoming more frequent. Just this month, we received documents that were redacted with information that we already had access to. We hope you can understand the predicament we're in. We're here to investigate decisions being made about children and youth in order to ensure their health, safety, and welfare. And yet, we're in a position of needing to request data from the agencies whose decision-making we are charged with investigating. We hope you can help us find a solution. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Online, we have Jill Kaholani.
Hello and good morning. My name is Jill Kaholani Ash. I'm the ombudsperson with the Office of Ombudspersons for American Indian Families. Due to the overwhelming disparities of Native children in child welfare, our agency was created in 2021 through the strong advocacy of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, the American Indian Community Specific Board, the American Indian Community, and others. Minnesota is number one in the nation for the removal of American Indian and Alaska Native children from their homes. Our office is the only independent state agency of its kind in the nation. By way of background, I've served in the role of Ombudsperson for American Indian Families since 2013. Prior to the creation of the Office of Ombudspersons for American Indian Families in 2021, I was housed with the Office of Ombudspersons for Families, a different agency. I'm testifying and to clarify our agency's support of HF 3901 as amended. Tribes are sovereign nations predating the existence of the United States. They have the inherent sovereign right to control how their data is collected, used, and shared. The support of the Office of Ombudspersons for American Indian Families to allow UFI to have direct access to the Social Services Information System, known as SSIS, will not include access to any data from tribes or foster youth who were placed by tribal child welfare. I would like to note that UFI and our office have collaborated and consulted with success when cases involved Native youth. This proposed legislation is for direct access to SSIS, which is an essential tool to help UFI carry out their statutory mandates. Access promotes transparency and accountability for the state's child welfare system. It also decreases the time burden for DHS, DCYF, or social service agencies in searching for and providing the necessary case information in response to any requests. HF 3901, as amended, clarifies and protects the foster youth ombudsperson's ability to review and investigate agencies responsible for supporting foster youth. Not all states have ombuds for children and families. For example, the state of Wisconsin does not have a dedicated ombuds for children or families. According to my research, there are 19 ombuds or child advocate offices who have reported they have access to their state's child welfare system for case records and documents. Minnesota should be among them. I agree and support the statements made by the Ombuds for Corrections, who also supports HF 3901. She said, ombudspersons must be able to receive and act on complaints, conduct investigations, review systemic concerns, work towards resolutions, and make recommendations regarding the activities of state and governmental entities with transparency and accuracy. And ombuds can only function well if the office is able to access data without impediments or influence by those who hold the data. I respectfully urge you to support HF 3901 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please stick around if you would in case there are any member questions. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? If not, we will move to member questions. Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had two questions. The first one has to do with adding Department of Corrections on line 2.1. And then there's some reference to the investigation of any action of any agency. And I'm just curious if you've talked to DOC about that. I think the last testifier mentioned the corrections ombudsperson. And so that's my first question. Thanks.
Is that to Representative Johnson or to the testifier?
The testifier is nodding. So okay. I feel like she has an answer ready.
All right. Very good. Go ahead and answer the question then, please.
Thank you, Representative. The reason that Department of Corrections and DHS are included is because they have some role in licensing certain types of placements for foster youth. So we're not looking at, like, we want all of the cases that, for instance, the Ombuds for Corrections is also reviewing. We would want specifically those cases that foster youth are placed in. We work closely, again, with Department of Corrections and the other Ombuds offices when there are overlapping scope areas, as well as any other licensing body. So if there is something that another licensing body is looking at, we're oftentimes just making sure, did you get the correct information that you were supposed to, and was it appropriately sort of triaged in the way it was supposed to?
Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That satisfies just the question I had about that. And then my next question has to do with lines 2.21 to 2.23. I know that the amendment struck without notice. So does that language now contemplate, A, that notice will be given in those situations? And then also I'm a little concerned about how broad that this enter an inspection is, especially when it includes areas for recreation or other activities. So I'm just curious what the impetus is for this language. Thanks.
Ms. Planout.
Thank you, Representative and Chair Scott. The Okay, so the enter and inspect language currently says examine any placement where a foster youth resides. The feedback that we heard was really that that examine language is sort of unclear. Like, does that mean examine in person? Does that mean examine a photo? So the enter and inspect was really just clarification of that specific provision. The notice requirement was removed because of some concerns, and really that was based on conversations we had with other ombuds offices around looking at a physical location, essentially that if there was a specific concern that someone was made aware of, that they could remedy it before it could be documented or noted by an office such as ours. The language around types of rooms or so recreation or discipline might be included as well. Sorry, I should have printed it and I do not have it in front of me. Was related to the visiting of primarily congregate care facilities that foster youth are staying at and whether or not our office was permitted access. So if there's a room that is a disciplinary room that young people are sent to and we are not permitted to see it, I think that is a question that we would have based on sort of what those requirements for those spaces are. And right now, since it doesn't explicitly, our statutes don't explicitly say that we can look at any area that we identify, we just wanted to be clear that those should be covered.
Chair Mueller? Okay. Any other, Representative Finke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to get clarity on one of those questions, though. If you take out without notice, there's no language. Is there language requiring notice currently, or is it still without notice? We're just taking that language out.
Thank you,
Representative.
Thank you. I think we would be happy to provide, if you would like us to provide explicit notice, we can do so in that language. It doesn't say at the moment. I think our preference would be to match sort of what the licensing notice requirements would be, which is they are allowed to do inspections without informing people ahead of time. But because there were concerns about that specific provision for us, I think that we are happy to sort of accept either path that feels most appropriate.
Representative Finke?
Okay, thank you.
It is hard to know what question to ask next, like, because there are different settings mentioned here.
Yeah, so we can follow up on
that. Some could be outside of the home.
I mean, we're either allowing notice or not allowing notice, and I feel like that, if it's no notice, I can understand the need for that. I just feel like taking out the language without notice and then continuing to act without notice makes me feel a little uncertain about it, but, you know, no need to further this.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Plan Alp, do you have another comment?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to clarify, Representative. So currently we do provide notice. We have not, even though our statute is kind of silent on the matter, we have not chosen to try to inspect a facility or a home without notice. So we do provide notice.
Let's do this. Let's ask House Research. Let's ask Mr. Hopkins for his kind of interpretation of removing that without notice clause. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, so without notice has been struck by the amendment, but there is no provision in the bill about how many hours or days of notice is required or anything like that. The bill is silent on that current.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rarick, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when courts have to decide what we mean, I'm going to turn to the author of the bill to say, what's your intent? So what is, by taking that out, it actually does make it more confusing. It's very clear that you have to either provide notice or not provide notice, but you've taken that language out completely. So as the author of the bill, what is your intention so that when the courts come and look at this later, they can hear what your intention is?
Representative Johnson.
Well, I think is what can happen and what this shows is that the intention and the amount of working and talking together that there was to make sure everybody was, it's clear, and it seems like the more you talk, the more unclear it is. The intention is, and I believe our testifier mentioned, that we want to clear that up and make sure that we don't get caught on being able to make a notice and saying, well, what is a notice and how much notice you need to be. By taking out and say without notice relieves that framework that says, well, you didn't give us a 2-hour, you didn't give us a 3-hour, you didn't give us a 5-hour, whatever, 2-day notice. So I think by putting that in there was to be able to more freedom. Could it be better? It probably can be, because the courts will get involved one way or another. And I'm definitely willing to, I know this is being laid over, so we can still work on it to get clarification on that. So,
Chair Eric, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So yeah, that's the right answer. You're going to need to clarify in the language, because it's actually a really big deal. And if you're not going to give notice, which is what this was, that's an unexpected sort of site visit. And in the world of fraud, we found that an unannounced site visit is incredibly important. So if you want to act quickly on a response from, you know, a vulnerable foster, you may want to show up. And just, you know, if they're in danger or something is going awry terribly, maybe you want to show up without notice. But I think you need to clarify in the language so that the agency has the proper authority or not. So this is something that if this is going to move forward, you're going to need to clarify, I think. That's because right now it is kind of muddy.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Thank you for that suggestion as we try to get this addressed and stuff like that. I think I'll just leave it at that and address it in the closing comments. Thank you.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. So I was just going to note that it is being laid over, so we don't have to solve the problem today. And I think that there might be a solution in some language that gives the agency the authority to do it without notice when there's some kind of mm-hmm. the agency believes there's a need for speed, urgency, not giving notice, and that in other more routine situations that there would be some kind of notice. So I just as a suggestion, but I think we can probably move on because we do have other bills and. You know, thanks for the discussion.
And thank you, Chair Liebling. Just for the record, just a couple of comments of concern that I have is 2.23, you're adding or other activities. That's pretty broad. And then at the top of page 5.1, another broad statement, any other data pertinent to an investigation by the ombudsperson. So some of this language is very broad. Also, I think there are concerns with I know I have concerns for complete access into the online system because there's very sensitive information on that website. There's adoption records, there's case notes, and some other sensitive information. So I think if you're going to have access to that, it has to be narrowed as to what exactly you can have access to, and I just don't know how practical it is and how common it is for anyone, especially outside of that agency, to have just carte blanche access. So those are my concerns with the bill. And Representative Johnson, final comments, and we will lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for those comments, and we're continuing to work on it. I know it's being held over. Here's the most important part of this bill is the fact that it is taking in a situation where timing matters and how quickly you can get to the information you need matters. And what's happening is things are going the other directions. It's going weeks and months. And so I don't want to see a story that comes out now and says, what happened to this family? What happened to this child? And stuff like that, because one department will not talk to another department and doesn't have access to their information. That is my real concern right now. And if this bill would help address that, so hopefully I know it's being laid over. It's very important that we start doing that because these kids, time matters. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I really appreciate hearing this bill, and I know that you have a sincere concern for these kids. And with that, House File 3901 is laid over. Members, we are going to move to House File 4428. Chair Liebling has agreed to hear the Novotny bill on Thursday, which is House File 962. Just for the public's information, we received, we had a fiscal note last year on this bill that was zero from the courts, and at 10:40 last night, we received from the courts a fiscal note for 15 new FTEs, which I find very disappointing. And so we will we will be hearing that bill after we've had more time to digest why the change in the fiscal note. And with that, Representative Nadeau, please take your seat at the table and present House File 4428. This bill is also being laid over, so I will move it before the committee. House File 4428 is before us. It looks like, Representative Nadeau, we have an A1 amendment. Is that your amendment?
Yes.
Okay. And would you like to briefly tell us about the amendment, and then we can take a vote on that?
I'm sorry. This goes back a little bit. I think the A1 is language that DHS needed for conformity.
Okay. Disclosure to the Commissioner of Human Services, it says, is
yes.
The title of it. Okay.
Yep.
Any member discussion on the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 has been amended on. To your bill, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling, Chair Liebling, as well, for hearing House File 4428. This bill creates a new section of law in Chapter 256B establishing the work or community engagement requirements that Congress made. Congress made changes to federal law governing states' Medicaid programs. H.R. 1 changed those eligibility rules, financing requirements, and included establishing work and or community engagement requirements for Medicaid enrollees who are adults without children. House File 4428 establishes the federal community engagement requirements in state statute. Section 1 of the bill establishes those CE requirements. It addresses exemptions. It provides guidance for determining and verifying compliance or the failure to do so. It includes outreach responsibilities and directs DHS to work with counties. But as I understand it, this committee is more concerned with Sections 2, 3, and 4 of the bill. Section 2 and 3 of House File 4428 amend Statute 268.19. Section 2 permits data gathered on an individual under the employment insurance program to be shared without consent of the individual. And Section 3 allows DEED to share this information with DHS for the purposes of administering the MA community engagement requirements. Section 4 of this bill amends Minnesota Statute 270B, allowing Department of Revenue to disclose tax return information with DHS for the same limited purposes established in this new section of law. That's the extent of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Chair Liebling.
So thank you, Madam Chair. And so this bill, of course, is being laid over. So it's, I suppose, so that when it comes up on the floor, it can be said that it came to this committee. So I just want to make a short comment about this, because I think there are many members on this committee who aren't on the Health Committee or on Human Services maybe and aren't as aware of this. The so-called efforts to comply with what we call the big ugly bill, and there are many other names for it that are less complimentary. And I just want members to understand what this is really doing as we, before we lay it over. I don't know if it would pass this committee if it were getting a vote. It probably would not, I suspect, at least not in current form. But this is what Congress did to kick people off of medical assistance, Medicaid. These requirements are going to hurt any member who has health care in their district and whose constituents need health care, which is all of us, anybody who has people on Medicaid in their district, which is all of us, in particular, members who represent more rural areas. This is going to hurt not only your constituents, but it's going to hurt the healthcare facilities in your districts. The main issue here is when we kick people off of medical assistance, they still get sick, they still need to go to emergency rooms, they still need healthcare, and your healthcare, your small hospitals end up with a lot more uncompensated care. And that is the base issue. So this is the Republicans in Congress pushing this down onto you, making you do their dirty work. This is what is happening here. So I just want to make that very clear to everybody. It's not about even the nuts and bolts of whether we should share people's private information, allow it to be shared for purposes of helping to kick them off of Medicaid, but that is what is happening in this bill. So thanks for letting me make that comment, Madam Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, or Chair Liebling. I'm happy to have the health component debate. This, you know, what we're here for is, are we going to conform with the federal government or not? And ultimately, we will conform one way or the other. We have some options. There's not a lot of guidance that the federal government has provided us at this point. I'm not here to defend what Congress has done or not. I'm here to try to limit the negative impact that's going to happen in Minnesota. And so we have a few options. We can either conform to the community and work standards, and remember, members, that the requirement to be eligible for free health care in Minnesota is 80 hours of work or 80 hours of volunteering per month. 80 hours at federal minimum wage. $580 someone has to earn in a month to be eligible for this. We've worked through a lot of the exemptions. We've made many of them. Agencies need 65 for this conformity. The Department of Human Services needs 65 FTEs in order to abide by this conformity. There's lots of challenges. I don't want to have the fight too much. We recognize the issues here, but we are either in a place where we could possibly lose $1.5 billion in federal funding, or we could lose $3.5 billion in federal funding. I'm trying to minimize the impact to Minnesota.
Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Doe, for being here.
Thank you.
All right, next up, Representative Frederick. I think we'll be fine. Representative Frederick, welcome back to the committee. Let's move your bill before us, House File 4478, and let me get the right folder here. All right. And I believe there's an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, can I give the brief background story before I discuss the amendment?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Can I give the background story of,
yes,
of the problem,
yes,
that we're trying to...
Please, okay, go ahead and Representative Moeller moves House File 4478 before the committee. Go ahead with your comments, Representative Frederick.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, thank you. I want to paint the picture of the problem that I'm trying to solve. Right now, individuals that have been civilly committed into the Minnesota Sex Offender Program are currently using our data access laws to gather as much information they can on the staff of those programs and then go to them in those settings and being like, hey, I saw a week ago you got written up. You were tardy for work. What's going on? Or a month ago, I saw you had a one-day suspension. What's going on there? Or they're using information about where they went to school and say, oh, I saw you went to school at this location. Do you have family there? And they're just using our laws in a way to weaponize them and try to bully and intimidate the staff in these programs. I had an original amendment, the DE1, which was a little bit more aggressive, and it just said that they can't access that data, but it went a step farther because there is actually a community, some advocates, I guess I would call them, on the outside, maybe about 20 or so people, that are also requesting that same data to feed it into the sex offender programs. It's the same group that thinks that we should unlock the door to these programs and let all of the sex offenders out into the community because, in their view, the incarcerated people or the civilly committed individuals there are the true victims. And so there is a problem that we need to address, where our data is being accessed both by people in the facility and outside the facility and being used in a way to bully and harass the staff that is there. So In my DE1, it said that those data requests could not be anonymous as a way to stop that information from flowing in. Chair Scott and some open government folks had some concerns. And I think that that's important to address those concerns too, which is how we landed on the DE2. The DE2 aims to address the same concerns about preventing that information from going into a secure treatment facility. It does leave in place the ability to anonymously request data, but it allows the facilities to put rules in place to try to prevent that information to come in. So this is, I think, what would be, I would say, negotiated language that attempts to solve the problem. And if a year from now or 2 years from now, if they have found a way to manipulate the system further, I would hope that this committee would be open to furthering the conversation at that point. But I think this is a great step, and I appreciate the feedback, Chair Scott, that you had into the amendment, and hopefully this one you support.
Thank you, Chair Frederick, and thank you for working with Minnesotans for Open Government. And I think this is a good solution, and, you know, as is with anything around this place, if it needs to be revisited, it will be revisited. Well, hopefully. That's not always, there has to be willing parties. So any member discussion on the A2 or the DE2? Oh, yeah. I need to move the DE2. I will move the DE2 before us. Now we'll have member discussion on the DE2. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. It's adopted. Any member discussion on this bill? Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the bill. Fine with the way it is with the DE now, but just food for thought for the future. If it does continue to be a problem, perhaps tacking on a consequence or a penalty for the person that anonymously gets the data and then provides that data to somebody who is civilly committed. Thanks.
Well, there you go, a proactive idea already. All right. any other member discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of House File 4478 as amended?
Is it going to the GR?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is going to the General Register. Okay. Representative Mohler will renew her motion that House File 4478 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Frederick.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto, Chair Pinto is in the House. We're going to hear from him. Chair Pinto, I will move House 71775 before the committee. And are you wanting to send this back to public safety, or what is your plan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be the request. That would
be
to send it back to public safety. They'll consider, I'll just note any fiscal considerations would be in that committee's jurisdiction. So, yeah, if you could, that'd be great.
Okay. Okay, perfect. So House File 1775 is before us with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Go ahead and tell us about your bill, Representative Pinto.
Thank you so much, Chair Scott. Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. House File 1775 is intended to move us along the path of examining our pretrial justice system. This is an issue that's very important to members from across the political spectrum, ideological spectrum as well. It's a bill that is about collecting data about our criminal cases in the pretrial stages. You'll see in the bill this long list of data to be collected and gathered, and then have that information be available for researchers to examine, to make proposals for improving our systems. You'll note in the packet of letters there's support from a number of different groups, Minnesota Justice Research Center, Center of the American Experiment, and others, recognizing that having access to data is really helpful to all of us, and I do have a testifier, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Hall. I'm a criminal defense attorney at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, and I led the Minnesota Justice Research Center's pretrial best practices project. In 2023, the legislature asked the MNJRC to take a look at Minnesota's pretrial system and recommend policy changes for the legislature's consideration. Our preliminary report, which was submitted on February 15 of 2024, recommended that the legislature create a statewide pretrial data system. And this bill is one step toward making that happen. Members, the problems with Minnesota's pretrial system are clear and well documented. The MNJRC's 2025 report, also submitted to this body, explores those issues in detail. But without comprehensive pretrial data, we can't understand the scope of the problem. For example, all else being equal, people detained pretrial are more likely to plead guilty than those who are released pretrial. But how much more likely? How many people does this impact in our state? We don't know the answers to that. We know people living in greater Minnesota are more likely to be jailed pretrial than their Twin Cities counterparts. How much more likely? How does it impact their case outcomes in their communities? We don't know the answers to those questions either. A pretrial data system is also essential for measuring the impact of any changes to that system that this body may make in the future. States like New Jersey and Virginia have already seen the benefits of a statewide pretrial data system. House File 1775 would enhance the transparency of Minnesota's pretrial system, and it would increase public confidence in the fairness and equity of the system. Minnesotans deserve to know whether the policies that affect their lives are consistent with the values that they hold dear, like safety and equity. I urge you to adopt House File 1775. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will move on to member questions. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Pinto, with this fiscal note coming in with quite a substantial cost, my question is, we're going to gather this information and help me understand on line 3.28, we're going to give access to this information that's going to be granted to research institutions. Is it your intent of this bill that this information that's collected is only available to a research institution?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Novotny, I'll note, I'm expecting the cost. There have been a lot of conversation going on with agencies. You know, this is a preliminary fiscal note. I'm expecting the cost to go down in conversation with the agencies. There's been some confusion about exactly what was expected, and I think some thought from agencies there's more expected. So just a preliminary comment. The reason that the bill is drafted regarding research institutions is we want to at least make sure it's available for research, and narrowing it seemed to cut down the cost somewhat, but there's no sense of wanting there to be a gatekeeping function on what kinds of research institutions or researchers could get access to this. We want to make sure that it's available to, of course, members of the public conduct research, but having a sort of originally, the earlier version of the bill, you may remember, had like a public dashboard, and there's just a lot of cost associated with that. And so, no sense that if there's anybody who wants to conduct research on this data, we certainly do not want to be getting in the way of that, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, and just wondering if you'd be interested in some clarifying language before this gets to make sure that highlights the fact that someone other than a designated research institution would be able to find this. Otherwise, we're paying a lot of money to gather a lot of information that is very compartmentalized held. A side note, I'd like to know, give me some advice on how to convince the courts to drop their numbers on these outrageous fiscal reports on reports and information that they're already required to provide.
Chair Pinto, any response?
Just thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Novotny, yeah, very interested in language. In fact, working on some clarifying language right now to deal with the issue I brought up before, where there was some confusion with the agencies about what was expected. So I very much want to, of course, incorporate your thoughts about how to make sure there's broad access. I will note one thing that jumped out at me, this may be of interest to the chairs and the committee. There was not a cost to the courts because in all cases, we're just asking for data that's already collected to be transmitted, and it turns out there's no data linkage between the corrections department and MSGC, so there's a cost there. But there is a data linkage between the courts and Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you, I'm assuming funded through this committee originally. And so there's no additional cost now to the courts to do this because they're just taking data they already collect and sending it over a data linkage that already exists. So that's a very good thing, the challenges within the DOC. Looks like the chair may have a question about that. Chair Scott, I mean.
Yeah. So no, not so much a question about that, but just to concur with Chair Novotny.
Yeah.
And I should have come prepared with an amendment to address who all has access to this data. But in looking over all of the data that is being collected and compiled, and I haven't looked at it through a fine-tooth comb, but most all of this data, from what I can tell, is already public data. So the public should have a right to it anyway. And so if we're going to be aggregating that data through the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, I believe that any member of the public should have access to it. It shouldn't just be limited to research entities for access to that. And so I would hope if this does reach the House floor that we would see language to that effect. Now, my next question to you is, can the Sentencing Guidelines Commission comply with data requests that they may get regarding that information? And would they then have a fiscal cost? Chair Pinnell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good question regarding that latter piece. We're right now, as I say, trying to figure out how to have this bill be at a cost where Chairs Novotny and Moeller are in position to fund it and also make sure we achieve all the goals we have. There's a strong interest, again, across the spectrum in making sure that this happens. And we want to make sure we're complying with data requests from whatever agency has. The point was to have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission serve simply as a place where the information is gathered, and then those who want to conduct research on it, of whatever background, can do so. And so I guess we'll have to look into, I'm not sure, we'll need to get back to you regarding exactly how they have to respond. But I think if a government agency has data, they of course have to be responding to a request for data. So right. Something to consider. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I think it's going to be some valuable data that we're going to be getting. And I know the Sentencing Guideline Commission already does have some, because a few years ago we looked into it and found out that fully across the state, 40% of felony charges, for instance, were being downwardly departed. And so that was a very troubling statistic. So I do know that they already have some data. Any other member discussion on this bill? All right. Is Representative Moeller move this bill too, or would that mean? Oh, you know what? Okay, we're just going to go with Representative Moeller. She renews her motion that House File 1775 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you. The bill is on its way back to public safety, where the two chairs that sit in this very committee are going to look forward to having it.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Liebling, some comments.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Before we adjourn, I just wanted to note that for the hearing on Thursday, that we have moved the amendment deadline to 10 a.m. Am I right, Mr. Sandy? Right. So I just, because I had said noon before, and just to give us all more time, if there are amendments, I don't know, I'm going to have some amendments just to get the fiscal pieces of the bill in the order in which I would like to see them move forward. But, I don't know if other members have amendments planned, but the deadline will be 10 a.m. on Wednesday. So just please get your amendments going if you plan to have any. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you for that announcement. And with that, we are adjourned.